Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Sarah and I have talked many times about our desire to age as gracefully as possible, and skincare is a huge piece of that. I spend a lot of time and money thinking about my skin, and I have added Ritual to my routine, which just gives me a lot of comfort. Ritual is here for us. They have created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted clinical studies, so we know it's working. They're taking the guesswork out of skincare. Ritual Hyacera is one of several Ritual products that I love. I take the daily multivitamin, I take a probiotic, and Hyacera is that once daily skincare supplement that is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. I recently met a friend for the first time in person as opposed to online, and we were discussing the fact that I am 43, and she said, "I cannot believe how young you look." And I thought, thank you, Ritual, for that. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
We've got Beth on the line from Scotland.
And we're sharing my interview on criminal justice reform with Derek Cohen.
This is Sarah from the left.
And Beth from the right.
You're listening to Pantsuit Politics.
No shouting, no insults, plenty of nuance.
Today we're going to do a quick update on the situation in London, share Beth's interview on criminal justice with Derek Cohen, and talk about something besides politics and the heels. Plus, we still are ongoing with our membership drive. We're trying to reach $3,000, so a month pledged, so that Pantsuit Politics is officially in the black. So if you can help us, any little bit counts, and you open up this whole secret garden of additional benefits, which is really exciting. We just did a Tipsy Pantsuit Politics that is available to all patrons right now, so you don't want to miss that. So go to patreon.com/pantsuitpolitics, or you can go to our website, pantsuitpoliticsshow.com, and click Become a Supporter.
So, Sarah, I am talking to you from a hotel room in Edinburgh, Scotland. We just left London, and when I went to bed, we went to bed kind of early last night because we knew we were leaving for an early tour today, and I'd been asleep for maybe an hour, and suddenly I started hearing my phone just blow up, and I thought, what in the world? I mean, the time difference is significant, so it wasn't surprising to hear like the first ding, but then it just over and over and over. And I got up and I had all these messages that were like, oh my God, are you okay? And we had no idea that there had just been an attack on London Bridge.
So I just, my brain decided that you were already in Scotland. So I was like, no, I saw a picture. I guess I woke up the next day and was like, I saw Roland's Scottish Hills. So she's safe and I will not even consider that something could have happened otherwise.
Yeah. Well, it was really weird to start digging into it and realizing that it happened. We stayed in Southwark while we were there, which is right by London Bridge. the night before it happened, we walked through Burroughs Market, where the stabbing took place after attackers plowed their van into people on London Bridge. It is such a nice area, and it's just, it's horrifying to think about. I mean, so Borough Markets, it's like there's this grocery store that you walk through, and there are just baskets of fresh produce everywhere. There are lots of little pubs. It's just a very kind of up-and-coming area. Chad likened it to OTR in Cincinnati, where you can tell that it's been there a long time, and it's been sort of revitalized. So it's just it's almost hard to imagine that it went from being this peaceful, fun, chill place where we were to the scene that took place there.
And so yesterday they had 3 attackers, 7 people were killed, and like 28 people were injured. Is that right?
That matches what I heard most recently, although it seems like they're trying to be very careful, at least on the BBC reporting of it. You keep getting a sense of like, here's what we know right now. We're trying to be precise. We're not going to get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. Well, and what bums me out about it, I don't know about the coverage there, but the coverage here is basically all about what Donald Trump has said and tweeted. And, you know, I just don't think that's the point right now.
That has definitely not been the coverage here. The coverage here has been, to the extent that it's been political, it has been about how will this impact the upcoming election. Should they have the upcoming election, or should it be postponed? Theresa May suspended campaigning today. It's June 8th, so it's just a couple of days away.
Wow.
But the mayor of London, I watched a pretty extended interview with him this morning. Something that he said that I really liked, I don't get what I'm seeing from the United States about his statements, because just scrolling Twitter, which I haven't done a lot of today. I mean, I was up in the Scottish Highlands, so we tried to pretty well unplug. But just from what I've seen, I feel a sense of criticism of London's mayor, which is hard for me to understand, because I thought his statements this morning were so thoughtful. He said, just as terrorists are constantly, the question posed to him is, what do you do about this, right? If somebody's willing to just plow their vehicle into people, how do you prevent that? And he said, just as terrorists are always adapting their ways, so are we in law enforcement. Mm. And we're constantly working on it, and we do not accept this as normal. So I don't know where the sense of sort of appeasement that seems to be coming through in US media is coming from, but it's definitely not what I've seen here.
Well, what bothers me so much about sort of the criticism of him and the intense coverage of Trump's statement is, for one thing, I don't think it's appropriate for the president of the United States to get on Twitter and start attacking the leader of a city that was just had a terrorist attack. Just generally, I don't think that's an appropriate thing to do. There seems to be, I know this is the understatement of the century, but no recognition of sort of the power of his soapbox and how it should be used. Very responsibly. So that bothers me too. And to use this tiny little part of what he said, and there's no assumption or giving of the benefit of the doubt that, of course, this man who lives in this city and whose citizens he represents were just killed cares as much, if not more, than anyone about making sure that safety comes first and that people aren't in danger. And this so soon after the Manchester attack, it's just so upsetting. And I think, why can't we give him the benefit of the doubt?
Or just watch the whole interview, because he's angry. I mean, it's clear that he cares about this. And I don't, it's interesting to be here to see the BBC coverage versus being in the United States and seeing the tiny threads that are pulled out.
Well, and what's going on with the coverage generally of the election up until the attack? Because my husband was saying he's been following Rob Delaney on Twitter, who is an American comic who now lives in London and films a show called Catastrophe, which we've talked about on the show before, and I highly recommend. And he was saying, like, he's like, well, most of what I'm getting is from Rob Delaney, but he was saying that it seems to be shifting against the conservative Theresa May's party, and she might have to have a coalition government.
I think that that could be true. It sounds like the general consensus is that Theresa May thought this was going to be an opportunity to really consolidate power, and that she's kind of blown it in the election process. But that Jeremy Corbyn is also just totally unacceptable to people. Jeez. And so you have, you know, Chad was talking about hearing an interview with someone today who said, look, I'm more of a Labour kind of person, but I'm going to vote because I think Theresa May is the better option of these two. You just had The Economist coming out advocating voting for a third option because it felt that the Conservative Party and the Labour Party are just off base. So it's really pretty interesting. I think what people thought was going to be a snooze fest could be something to watch.
Yeah, and it looked like there was a lot of coverage. It was really interesting to me because the Democratic Party is starting to subtly, or maybe not so subtly, shift to a single payer healthcare debate. And, you know, so many memes about single payer healthcare are, you know, no country chooses this and then goes back. The people who live in these countries are so happy with their single payer system. And then you go on Twitter and you look at the coverage of this election, which has turned into, in many ways, one of the last sort of hot point issues is the single payer system in Britain. They're not saying we don't want to have single payer anymore. They're saying you need the party that's going to fund it adequately because we have people waiting in beds dying, which is exactly sort of the scare tactics people use in the United States, I think, to argue against single payer. So it was really interesting to really go to their space on the internet where they're just debating it, and it's not sort of for global consumption. It's really the conversation they're having amongst themselves and see some of the issues they're having with their government healthcare.
We've heard a little bit about healthcare. Definitely the message in Scotland from the SNP is about properly funding healthcare, properly funding education, properly funding pensions. Lots of billboards about pensions here. I mean, it is. It just shows you that no system is perfect. Everybody has their issues. You know, I posted on our Instagram feed some graffiti from Old Town in Edinburgh that said, Scottish votes don't count. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the kind of sense here that some of us have about the Electoral College or about the way a particular region in a state dominates the state's voting because of the population size. I mean, just everybody has problems.
Right.
And the way that we deal with them feels very different and still kind of turns on just human nature and where people are. I can tell you, though, that we haven't heard anything flattering about the United States while we've been here.
Oh, that's such a bummer.
We've seen, well, that's not true. In the historical context, you know, the Churchill war rooms are such a testament to the relationship between Great Britain and the United States, and particularly the friendship between Churchill and Roosevelt. And walking through the war rooms, you just got such a sense of how important the NATO alliance is and how the United States leadership in the world is something special and is something to be preserved. The only two references to Donald Trump that we've really seen, one was a comparison to Hitler and one to Stalin. So it was a little extreme. But definitely nothing flattering. We were in Westminster Abbey. One of the people who worked there said, more Americans. I know why you're here. You know? and it's just kind of like an understood thing that this is pretty embarrassing.
Oh, that is so brutal. That makes me so sad.
It makes me sad, too. I hope that it's something that we can get past quickly. And I really don't get the sentiment that's being expressed around the withdrawal from the Paris Accords of this is America caring about itself instead of sort of cowering to the rest of the world, especially being in a different part of the world right now. I don't get any sense that anyone has ever thought that America was bending to anyone else's will.
Well, and I heard a very interesting interview on Pod Save America with one of the negotiators of the Paris Climate Accord. And he was saying, like, it is so foolish because if you're not, there's constant sort of jockeying among these accords to get the best for your country. And when you are not at the table to defend your position at all, then that is the most hurtful to your country's interest and economic and environmental and every other and energy economy and all those things. And so the idea that like you're protecting your country's interest by leaving the table is so foolish.
That's my concern. I don't pretend to understand climate science enough to say, does this agreement adequately combat environmental issues? I just have to take on faith that it doesn't make it worse, right? I have no idea. I believe climate change is a thing. I believe we contribute to it all the time. I believe that we could probably do better. That's the extent of my expertise on that subject, right? I have none. But I am concerned that we are, in the long run, really hurting our financial interests by withdrawing from this agreement, not to mention the foreign policy implications.
Mm. Absolutely. Considering that there's been a lot of news between the Paris Accords and the London, we have lots of fertile ground for compliment the other side. I guess I'm going to compliment, even though this is the sort of lightest of subject matters regarding all the different news that's taken place. I like the way he handled this a lot. And I wanted to say to compliment this person, because we're going to speak next week when Beth is back stateside about the recent PC controversies regarding Kathy Griffin and Bill Maher. And I really like the way Ben Sasse handled the Bill Maher thing, where he said, I wish I'd thought quicker. I wish I'd just not sat there uncomfortably and said, I should have said something, and I should have said this is unacceptable, and ended the interview. Like, I just appreciated his honesty with, like, because the truth is, we've all been there when somebody said something really, truly racist, and you're like so kind of in shock, you don't even know what to do. And so I kind of appreciated him just acknowledging that.
I agree with that. And I don't have an ounce of cynicism about the gap in time that it took for him to get there, because we do this podcast, which is, I'm sure, a lot less pressure than being on live television. And I always think of 15 things later that I wish that I had said in the moment. So I have total grace for him on that. My compliment is for Mark Warner, who I think is handling the Senate investigation into the election and all of the intelligence issues pretty admirably. I also saw a small clip of him being interviewed this morning about what happened in London, and he was emphasizing the way that we embrace the Muslim community in the United States, and that's why we have less radicalization than is happening in Europe. And so I thought that struck the right tone. One other thing I wanted to say about London before we move on is the our listener, Eric, who always, you know, challenges me to think about things in, from the more conservative angle, sent a tweet from Ben Shapiro today that said that Trump's tweets really give the left something to talk about instead of talking about radical Islam. And I get that. I don't think that's – I struggle with the left, right, and the right, because that's kind of the definition of no nuance about things. But I get the sentiment. We just turned off the BBC before you and I connected, and there was a woman who was saying that – the people who did this, and this was just a regular person who was interviewed on the street. So the people who did this say it's about religion. It's not. If it weren't religion, they would come up with another excuse. She said the people who do this are just violent, and they're cowards, and they're looking for ways to make themselves relevant in the world. And so don't let them hide behind religion.
Mm.
And I thought that was a really brilliant way to talk about this. And I understand the people who say we've got to confront that this is all attached to radical Islam. Fine. But I think this woman's right. And just as I would not allow the person who did the Portland stabbing to claim that it has anything to do with the God that I worship, I just think we ought to be careful about saddling other faiths with that.
So up next, we're going to share Beth's interview with Derek Cohen. We are special breakfast people here at Pantsuit Politics, but not just when Beth and I are on the road. The truth is, I want something warm from the oven every Saturday morning and Sunday morning. It's just the truth. It makes it feel special, makes it feel exciting. I don't want to work at it. So the first time I ever saw Wild Grain, which is bake from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, fresh pastas, and artisanal pastries, I was obsessed. You guys, I've been a member for over a year. It's amazing. It's so easy. Every item bakes from frozen in 25 minutes or less. No thawing required. You can fully customize your Wild Grain box. You can choose any combination of breads, pastas, pastries. You can even build a box of only breads, only pastas, or only pastries if you'd like. And for a limited time, you can get $30 off the first box, plus free croissants in every box when you go to wildgrain.com/pantsuit to start your subscription. Sometimes I make one single croissant just for me because I want to feel special, and they're so good. You heard me. Free croissants in every box and $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/pantsuit. That's wildgrain.com/pantsuit, or you can use promo code pantsuit at checkout. Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. You guys, I love my Aura frames. I have one in my office. I have one in my kitchen. I have given one as a housewarming gift. I have given one as Mother's Day, Father's Day. They are the most amazing gifts because this app is a game changer, in my personal opinion, in digital frames. It makes it so, so easy to get the pictures on there and even videos. It plays like you're in Harry Potter, you guys. It is the best. I love mine so much. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Can I get something off my chest? Every day I feel a little pang of sadness because I think about Griffin going away to college. Y'all, he's a freshman in high school. This is not healthy or normal. This is why I have it on my list of things to talk to my therapist about. We all carry around these things, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us. Therapy is a safe space to get these things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapist anytime for no additional charge. You gotta get it off your chest. And you can get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/pantsuit.
Yeah, if you don't mind to just kind of go through who you are and what you do and your experience.
Sure. Well, I'm Derek Cohen. I'm the Deputy Director for the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And we are the ones who started the Right on Crime campaign. As a Deputy Director, I oversee our operations both here in Texas. We have six policy staff here in Texas. We have three staff that do national communications. And then we also have six individuals who are state-level directors in states other than Texas as part of Right on Crime. My experience, I did my bachelor's at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. I did my master's and PhD at the University of Cincinnati. And, you know, coming up through there, I, you know, was kind of all over the place in terms of substantive subject matter. You know, everywhere from corrections to policing. I worked for the Corrections Institute. I worked for our Policing Institute. But all of them had a very common thread of the application of policy. So it was the natural progression to why I'm doing what I'm doing now.
And Debbie asked me to ask you to mention all of the different departments that you've consulted with. You know, she mentioned that you've done gang work, and it seems like you have a real breadth of experience in criminal justice.
Sure. And so, I mean, it's hard to say as far as departments on the Corrections Institute side, because obviously we worked very closely with the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. But, you know, that was more of a subcontract capacity. Now, in the Policing Institute, or the Institute for Crime Science at the University of Cincinnati, you know, we did basically violence suppression, would probably be the best way of the most accurate way of saying it, in New Orleans, in Detroit, in New Haven, Connecticut, you know, places that aren't exactly doing too hot in the and then obviously in Cincinnati too, but that aren't doing too hot in terms of gang violence. What that's doing is basically taking a model, you know, the don't shoot, the David Kennedy philosophy on suppressing gang violence in terms of basically putting downward force on a criminal network. And when I say network, I mean that is a specific term of art with nodes and individual components, basically being able to suppress that network through certain focal points. We basically facilitated with the police departments building that network, finding out what that network looked like. I mean, because they have this intelligence already, but taking that intelligence, being able to put it into a graphic that's easy to be understood, and then saying, okay, well, this is clearly the common point. Let's eliminate this common point. And usually the network crumbles. And the way you do that, though, is you say, okay, look, you know, we know that we're pulling your guys in for jaywalking and maybe theft or maybe public intoxication, you know, these low-level offenses. We're not going to go ahead, you know, we're not going to throw the book at people of your criminal network, you know, for those violations. But so help us. If you start shooting, you start robbing, you start hurting, you know, you basically start causing chaos, we are going to pull the jacket on every single case that we have on you, you know, from stealing a Twix bar down at the convenience store all the way up to armed robbery. We are going to hit you with the maximum amount of each one of those. And we're not going to do that in cooperate. We're also going to do that in cooperation with the feds as well. So you're going to have some racketeering statutes or some racketeering charges on top of that. So that here's an option. You can get out of this gang lifestyle. Here, we'll point you towards, you know, some social service providers and help you get out of there. Or, again, if bullets start flying, you're going to be going away for a very, very, very long time. And that's how you dismantle those networks. The only problem is they have basically, you know, those are usually ran as pilot projects in short term. But it's really something that needs to be a concerted strategy, you know, for 5 or more years. But rarely do these things last more than 2 or 3. And so you really never see the fruit. And again, this is my opinion. You really never see the fruits of that this program is capable of. You know, your first question was one of parallel jurisdiction. You asked what's the difference between federal, state, and local criminal justice systems. Well, that basically has to go all, that basically goes all the way back to the founding when you had, you know, the states, which, you know, confederated the federal government. And the federal government was tasked with enforcing laws that applied to the several states. Though the police power, and this is one of the important things because this informs a lot of work that we do and a lot of work that happens throughout the country, is that the police power wholly belongs to the states. And that's never been in dispute. Lines nowadays are a little more grayed than before. But with the police power belonging to the states, what do you do in cases where or multiple states have the equal application of power, or one state aggrieves another? Well, to do that, or to take care of questions like that, that's why they made the federal system, the federal criminal justice system. And not only that, but any sort of transnational crimes would also have to run through that as well. So the federal system got a little off kilter. And let me pause right there and go back. You also mentioned local. So most states are divided. I say most. All states are divided into counties, and each of these counties are the entities that can apply criminal justice at the local level. And then obviously they can also form cities within those counties as well, and that happens differently in different states. But the counties are usually the ones are seen as, you know, absent cities, the ones who are the local arbiters of criminal justice. They're the ones who at least have the common law judiciary. They have the sheriff's office. They also, you know, almost uniformly run the jails, no matter what state you're in. So the counties are the local folk, but what they do is they enforce state criminal justice policy. So basically the laws, the formalized social norms of a state, you know, are you know, are ubiquitous. You're from Kentucky. They're the same in Covington as they are in Paducah, as they are in Richmond. So the local entity is then tasked with enforcing them, and they can, again, interpret them within the boundaries of the discretion afforded them. They can interpret that as they see fit. The reason where things start to go off kilter from the federal perspective, or from the federalism perspective, I should say, is we get into these issues of the federal government taxing states, which, you know, they are well within their right to do, but the federal government taxing states and then putting conditions on returning that money through the forms of grants, through the forms of compliance incentives, whatever the case may be. You know, you're a lawyer, so you know as well as anyone else, the federal government can't say, okay, Boone County, Kentucky, you have to do this. Or, okay, state of Kentucky, you have to do this. But what they can say is, you will do this, or we're withholding 5% of all Bureau of Justice Assistance grants. Or we'll give you more access to grants if you get some sort of record sealing or orders of non-disclosure or some sort of expunction statute. And that's where it starts getting a little discombobulated. And that, unfortunately, is in the purview of the federal government, but it tends to lead to more, I'd say, well, how do I put this diplomatically? Things that have a lot of window dressing, but don't have a lot of chops when it comes to the policy itself. Most specifically, you're hearing a lot of talk now about the Redeem Act that Rand Paul and Cory Booker are putting out. And while it does address certain elements of the criminal justice system that actually should be taken care of and do need to be taken care of, we're talking about, you know, combating gender disparities in the federal system among juveniles. Well, in the federal penal system, we have all of 22 kids in the federal system, you know, and even with the grand scheme of all prisoners in the federal system, maybe 6% are female. So we basically have, you know, maybe two girls at most in the federal system. So I really don't understand what the purpose of some of that particular legislation is. But the problem is all the other elements of the Redeem Act are done through that cooperative federalism model that we've talked about before. Now, are you with me up until this point?
Yeah, I want to stop you for a second and ask a question.
Sure.
So you talked about how states make laws and states entrust local governments to enforce those laws. It's a little bit different with the federal government vis-a-vis the states, right? We're not expecting state troopers to enforce federal criminal laws. So can you talk a little bit about that enforcement mechanism, or are we? And if we are, you know, is that where the conditions on funding come in? I think this is really important as it relates to two issues that I know our listeners are interested in, the first being sanctuary cities and the second being marijuana.
Well, can I do that in reverse order, especially
Absolutely.
With the marijuana? Because if you actually look at the deputizing of state or local entities for the enforcement of federal law, marijuana brought that to a head right from the get-go in California. So, you know, 2005, Gonzalez v. Raich, basically the court case where Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez was basically saying, we're going to enforce federal law in the state of California after the state of California had already legalized marijuana, or at least, you know, strongly decriminalized marijuana. So what the federal government was doing was partnering with sheriffs, and these were sheriffs that were not necessarily in support of marijuana legislation reform, and they were making arrests and doing seizures and forfeitures and sending people to federal facilities for violating federal law, even though state law was at least silent, if not explicitly condoning the behaviors that they were doing. So marijuana really brought that to the head. Now, it's different how that can work, though, because you have the Prince decision, and the Prince decision simply says that, you know, hard stop, bright line rule, the feds can't tell locals what to do. So you mentioned sanctuary cities. This is where this comes in. And I don't know how much you follow the Texas legislature, but I was up till about 1:45 in the morning. Our sanctuary cities bill just went through earlier this week, and we could come back to that, but more on sanctuary cities more generally. is that if you look at sanctuary cities, and there, it has to say that there really is no commonly held definition of sanctuary cities. Generally, what people are referring to is that the local authority, not the state, but the local authority, the subsidy of the state entity, is telling the federal government to pound sand when they say, you have so-and-so, you have John Doe, or if you have them, please do not release them. We'll send somebody there to pick them up, or make sure if you do release them, you release them into our custody. And what was happening was some of the more progressive and liberal local entities, Travis County, Texas being one, where Austin is, basically told the feds to pound sand. Now, here's the most unpopular thing about the whole sanctuary cities debate from a conservative perspective. The local entities are fully within their rights to comply or not comply with any ICE detainer. Because keep in mind, an ICE detainer has absolutely no force of law. It is simply a gentleman's request that you do not let so-and-so go when you're ready to let them leave the facility. You remand them into our being the federal government's custody. So the local entities are fully able to tell the federal government to go fly a kite because the federal government has no plenary power over the local entities. The federal government can withhold grant funds. They can withhold other forms of material support. Again, this is where a true conservative will then make the point that, well, maybe they shouldn't be getting handouts from the federal government to begin with, or if the federal government has more than enough to go around where they can pick winners and losers with those who take or do not take their policies, maybe we should be taxed less. Different story for a different time. But that's perfectly within their rights. Now, the unpopular part of sanctuary cities on the left that they don't want to admit is that the state is well within their limits, because you have to keep in mind that counties and especially cities, and again, when we talk about sanctuary cities, don't think of this as cities. It's not cities, they're counties. You know, this is, because again, counties run the jails. So when we have counties, you know, not complying with ICE detainers, the state government is well within its bounds to step in and say, okay, listen, now you must comply with ICE detainers, which to me really, don't get me wrong, I mean, in Texas, I think 99% of our counties or 99% of requests are honored in Texas anyway. The bigger thing is look at what that looks like from a limited government, you know, somewhat autonomy, somewhat local control oriented state. Is that you're basically telling, or should I say handcuffing, local entities and how they're going to actually handle these complex federal issues. Now, there's obviously political hay to be made there. You'd have to be very obtuse not to see that. The efficacy of sanctuary cities policies or anti-sanctuary cities policies, to be honest with you, I don't see them mounting to a hill of beans one way or another. Again, this is one of the things where the right has their talking points, the left has their talking points. The right sees, or at least demagogues, so many of the people that come across the border as, you know, people of bad hombres, if you will. And don't get me wrong, there are many who do. The problem is that is far from the plurality of the people that come across the border. Now, the left, though, likes to use that and retreat to the talking point. Well, first, you know, immigrant communities are less crime prone than native born communities. Well, that's true in that first generation wave. Second generation, or those naturally born here, tend to be higher of a higher criminality than those. Now, that doesn't mean anything. This happens to do just the couple of times that we've measured these communities and we've actually measured how the crime, because these are really hard scientific questions to answer. You know, these were just the snapshots in time. I'm sure that it probably doesn't correlate that much with country of origin. It probably doesn't correlate that much, probably even less with race. What it is you do have some criminals coming over. You have criminals here. I think it's just a lot of political window dressing when it comes to the end of the day, and there's not that much going on either side of the debate.
So we have two problems, I think, in the criminal justice system that really concern our listeners. And the first is the war on drugs and the relationship between the war on drugs and a situation of mass incarceration in our country. And the second is a concern about the school to prison pipeline, that we're getting kids into the criminal justice system too soon and they're getting trapped there. So can we start with the sort of mass incarceration and talk about when we talk about the war on drugs and mass incarceration, are we talking about a state issue or a federal issue or both? And I know that your work right now is in criminal justice reform, and I would love to hear about kind of where you think this should go.
Sure. Well, there's a lot there.
We're not keeping it light on this one.
Yeah, no worries. Mass incarceration, I mean, that's a very tough question, because definitionally nobody's answered what mass incarceration is. When you ask, you know, when you ask your Michelle Alexanders or your Grace Nakamura, or not Grace, I can't remember her first name, but Dr. Nakamura, you ask these questions of, you know, what is mass incarceration? The retort is, well, we have 25% of the world's prisoners and 5% of the population, which that statistic just bothers me. But, you know, there's really no articulation of what mass incarceration is. My best assessment, and I don't know if mass incarceration is even the proper term of art for it. My best assessment is the fact that we look to we society collectively, and pretty much, you know, this does exist in both, you know, both camps. We tend to look at the carceral sanction. We look at putting somebody on the other side of iron bars as the modal way of handling, you know, violations of social norms. And I mean, that's, and I think wrongly, it's, we do that because it's perceived as tough. And, you know, I think just our work here in Texas that we've shown, you know, going for incarceration first is usually anything but tough. We can talk more about that later, but I don't want to get too much into the weeds on that. But when it comes to mass incarceration, we, you know, there's no arguing that we do have, at least for a liberal democracy, we do have an awful lot of people behind bars. Now, that was, in my opinion, and again, I wrote my dissertation on this, so I've delved into it just a little, but it's also, you know, an opinion too. If you generally look at what happened, you know, there was this perfect storm of events. We're coming out of World War II. We have, you know, the ethnic composition of major cities, especially those in the north, are entirely changing. There are a lot of cultural shifts, a lot of the traditional values, and I don't mean traditional values in terms of religion or anything like that, but a lot of the controlling values on social norms were not necessarily under assault as the conservatives saw them to be, but they were changing, you know, and time was basically put on hold from 39 to 45 while we were collectively as, you know, as this massive alliance sought to fight a literal manifestation of evil as we saw it. So there really wasn't the kind of cultural fluidity in those years that you generally see. So afterwards, it was a lot of racing to catch up. And here's another oft-forgotten fact is that, you know, the crime rate was, you know, just kind of ticking along there at the bottom till about, you know, maybe, I don't know, mid to late 1950s. And then it started going up pretty precipitously. And that's not arguable. That is something that's been measured through multiple metrics and, you know, everything from local to federal statistics. The problem was at the time, we really had no understanding of criminology. We really had no understanding of what crime is or how criminals work outside of, you know, what was basically Marxist sociology. And that had a good, compelling narrative to it, some would say, but it didn't really explain crime. Now, and if you look at criminology today doesn't look like it looked 10 years ago, doesn't look like it looked 20 years ago, and so on and so forth. So I don't think we've landed on the sweet spot yet. But anyway, as that crime started to tick up, we had no idea what actually causes crime. We had no idea how to stop it. And we had a class of conservatives, I wouldn't even say conservatives, but people of more traditional mindsets that thought their values were under assault. So that really didn't leave many cards on the table when it comes to addressing what was a very real crime problem. Or what was a very, very keenly felt crime problem as well. So what did we start doing in the 1960s? Well, look at the campaign, and this is, and this, everyone traces it back here, but this was kind of just dipping a toe in the water. This wasn't the cataclysmic event. Everyone traces it to the candidacy of Barry Goldwater. Well, Barry Goldwater ran, you know, when he did his announcement speech, he ran that he was going to, I mean, he basically floated the first tough on crime message. He basically saw, he saw crime as a personal moral failing, which, you know, even today, most theories of crime still have that at least as a central core, was an individual moral failing, and we are going to make it so that people that have that individual moral failing will not wish to act on it. The only way we can do that is by deterring them. The only way we can deter them is through harsher and harsher sentences. And so then you start seeing that rhetoric creep into the start creeping into the body. Now, also during that time in the 1960s, where you had the ABA model model penal code, where you had a general liberalization of judges in the decades post World War II. And again, that's not something where you just stuck your finger in here like, oh, it feels liberal in here. That was something that was a very slow shift, but kind of followed the general culture at the time too. So you had that going on as well. And so now these conservative state legislatures and these, you know, and what was tantamount to conservative Congress, especially during the Nixon era, they started saying, okay, well, we're just going to be tough on crime now. Back up a little bit. You probably know as well as anyone else what happened to Barry Goldwater. Well, he won the quote-unquote Solid South, the band of states, not including Florida, right there across the southern part of the United States. And they said, okay, well, this war on crime, and again, that's my term I'm just using as a, you know, offhand, but this tough, I'll say, well, this tough on crime approach, you know, that is what's going to unlock the Solid South. You know, we, in those states, we haven't had a they haven't had a Republican elected since, you know, the end of Reconstruction in the 1870s. And so that was the, what they saw as the first cracking of the Solid South, or this is the Great Schism coming to an end. Well, the problem is that's a very limited perspective, because you fast forward 4 years. Who won those states, you know, after Goldwater? George Wallace. So, I mean, that tells you, you know, there was probably a little something else at afoot there. But whereas George Wallace then won the Solid South, the presidential candidate, Richard Nixon, was the one who was able to basically capitalize on that tough on crime messaging. Now, with the tough on crime messaging, though, there was other things going on, you know, and this is where the Republicans really, and again, keep in mind, I'm talking about party, not ideology here, and it's very important to keep that distinct, because everyone goes, oh, well, Republicans are conservative, Democrats are liberal, and that's, you know, obviously a very modern convention and subject to fluidity, and I think after November 8th, we're seeing even more fluidity in that particular assessment, but you know, back then, you basically had Democrat, you know, the South was conservative. There was no doubt about that. The South was overall conservative. But, Republican couldn't get elected dog catcher in DeKalb County, Georgia. The North was predominantly Republican, but it was more moderate. So you basically, and it wasn't monolithically Republican the same way that the South was monolithically Democrat. So you basically see in the Republicans in the North, you basically see them completely unable to get a handle on this crime issue. They're like, well, you know, we're kind of, you know, I mean, we should punish them. But, you know, the progressives back in the 1900s and the 1910s really had a good idea with an individualized treatment. Well, that went right out the window. They go, okay, well, no more individualized treatment, because that's a pathway for leniency. That's what the conservative Republicans said. The more moderate to liberal Republicans were, the moderate to liberal Republicans said that. The conservative Republican says, well, this individual stuff was way too, let me start over. The leniency was the conservative Republicans. The disparate outcomes was the liberal and moderate Republicans. So they were actually fairly fractured on that up in the North, but down in the South, you know, the Democrats really were unable to, you know, to basically thread the needle between what Northern Democrats wanted, who were, you know, more moderate to liberal themselves, than what Southern Democrats wanted, who were almost monolithically conservative. So you basically had a policy incoherence on the Democrat side, one that happened to be in the right place on the Republican side, and that's where the tough on crime kind of ethos generally just took off. And, you know, I'd say the culmination of that, and there's a lot of debate over this, but the culmination of that was in 1994, where Bill Clinton signed the Biden crime bill, which essentially, now, it's intellectually dishonest to say the Biden crime bill caused mass incarceration. It just funded it. It gave several billion dollars back to the states, solely earmarked for prison construction. Again, but they would just be building empty warehouses if they didn't already have the policies in place that were able to, you know, make to fill these facilities to capacity. That's exactly what happened here in Texas. In Texas, we actually had a pretty oddly progressive criminal justice code through the basically from the 1840s to when we became a state, you know, to about the early 1900s. Then it started tipping a little bit in the other direction. By the time we got to the 1990s, when it was George Bush and Ann Richards, they were going neck and neck for who could build the most prison. They ended up increasing the bed count here in the state, something like 270%. And we increased capacity that much. And, you know, we were getting to a point where we weren't able to build the amount that we actually needed. We were having a tough time procuring the concrete. So the mass incarceration, I think, was a product of the political storm. But I also think that there was a pendulum swinging back in a way, in that there was not that many. We did not necessarily have enough prisons and enough penal capacity and enough police to deal with the crime wave that started in the late 50s, early 60s. And the only problem is that pendulum swung back. It just went so far in the opposite direction. I think it's coming back now, but the problem is, again, just kind of cutting through all the rhetoric and seeing the forest from the trees. You mentioned the drug war as well. The drug war itself, it's complex, because the drug war in and of itself, or the prohibition of any drugs, be they from marijuana to heroin, it's tough to look at, because the drugs were one of the issues where criminal justice was ratcheted up on, especially marijuana during the Nixon administration, during the Reagan administration. The problem is that while the criminalization of marijuana, you know, in some states got really out of control, like state jail, or we call them state jail, but like, you know, the low-level felonies in some states, very few states have that. It really never was this, you know, 90% of the criminal justice system that I think a lot of the more bombastic reformers like to lead with. You know, currently, if you look at drug offenders, depending on the jurisdiction you're looking at, if you're looking at like drug offenders, just drugs hard stop, including trafficking, you know, those are about 40% to half of a state's, and this definitely varies across states, penal population. But when you look at like simple possession, the number's far lower. Now, I'll be the first to admit, if you look at prosecutors, you know, they can make what is actually a possession with intent to distribute without even rolling over in bed. And I think that there's a emerging theory about prosecutorial discretion guiding a lot of this. I just don't think it's fully fleshed out yet. So the question about the drug war is a bit of a red herring, but it's not to say that it did not have any impact on it. It just doesn't have this outsized impact that I think a lot of people think it does. I think the bigger part of it is the pivoting from a treatment and rehabilitation standpoint from what we had in the, you know, the early part of last century. And we weren't good at drug therapy or drug rehabilitation. We weren't good at it back then, but we at least tried that. But the problem is we forsaken that for the more punitive and the more retributive philosophy of, well, we'll just lock people up longer. And I think that is probably where the drug war had a more serious impact. But again, I don't think it was, you know, one of the major players.
Sarah and I have talked many times about our desire to age as gracefully as possible, and skincare is a huge piece of that. I spend a lot of time and money thinking about my skin, and I have added Ritual to my routine, which just gives me a lot of comfort. Ritual is here for us. They have created a wrinkle support skin supplement and conducted clinical studies, so we know it's working. They're taking the guesswork out of skincare. Ritual Hyacera is one of several Ritual products that I love. I take the daily multivitamin, I take a probiotic, and Hyacera is that once daily skincare supplement that is clinically proven to reduce wrinkles and fine lines and increase skin smoothness in 90 days. I recently met a friend for the first time in person as opposed to online, and we were discussing the fact that I am 43, and she said, "I cannot believe how young you look." And I thought, thank you, Ritual, for that. Start Hyacera to help minimize wrinkles without compromising on clean science. Hyacera from Ritual is a clinically proven skin supplement you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pantsuit. Start Ritual or add Hyacera to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/pantsuit for 25% off.
Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they make solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a double A cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. And they've even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit right. It's time to get your problems solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
There's not much worse than a dry, itchy scalp. Also, when you get your hair colored and then it does not last as long as you and your stylist discussed, it could be that unfiltered, mineral-filled water is the culprit. Hard water is a leading cause of damaged hair and dry, irritated skin, and about 85% of the United States uses hard water, filled with dissolved minerals and added chlorine. That's where Canopy's new filtered showerhead comes in. Canopy, known for their beauty hacks and reimagined humidifier, has revolutionized the filtered showerhead. Dermatologists recommended this unique three-stage filtration system greatly reduces contaminants and odors in your shower water, leaving you with healthy hair and glowing skin. Best of all, the Canopy filtered showerhead is hassle-free. Installation is a breeze, and its unique quick-release filter replacement feature allows for seamless filter replacement unlike any others on the market. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy filtered showerhead purchase today with Canopy's hassle-free filter subscription. Even better, our listeners can use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Hurry, your hair and skin will thank you.
So can you talk about the reforms that you've been working to advance?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you a little bit about the Texas story. So we started, I work for a conservative think tank. We started in 1989, mostly dealing with issues of school choice, taxes, you know, kind of the red meat issues for conservative policy nerds like myself. But we didn't start the criminal justice work until about 2005, Cap. And in 2005, again, keep in mind, this is 5 years into the Perry governorship. The Richards and Bush governorship just was an absolute arms race for facility building. We were building facilities at basically the speed that we were filling them up. And we get to 2005, and we're just at a breaking point. We couldn't get the cement to build the rest of the facilities just on a procurement issue, let alone to actually have to pay for it out of the budget. And the budget wasn't doing great that year anyway. So the Texas House was very conservative at the time. Tom Craddock, still in the House today, called Jerry Madden, this army engineer from Plano, it's up by Dallas, called him into his office and basically said, you're the new corrections chair, and the trick to your job now is you can't build any new facilities. That do whatever you have to do, I'll support whatever you need, but you just can't build any new facilities. You want to shoot them in outer space, that's fine, we can't build any more facilities. And so Jerry was basically dumbfounded, because what have we been doing with these people for so long? What are we going to do with them now if we simply have all these policies and these legal procedures that are set up to basically run that spigot right into that bucket, and that bucket being the carceral sanction, that bucket being putting people in prison or jail or whatever the case may be? How do you turn that ship after we've been doing this for 5 decades at this point? So he convened a group to start looking at what are the population drivers, where are we really seeing a lot of people coming to the system, returning to the system, failing to successfully exit the system. And what he saw was we basically had really high revocation counts on probation and parole. We had a hair trigger on whether or not we're going to revoke somebody. And they were just not, they weren't giving anybody any sort of benefit of the doubt. Conversely, with probation and parole, the more reform-minded and the more bleeding heart, quote-unquote, probation and parole officers were letting individuals stack up multiple violations. They wouldn't drop the hammer on them until, they had a rap sheet a mile long on probation violations. So it was the worst of both worlds. It was either you mess up once and you get the book thrown at you, or you mess up 100 times, and that's probably a facetious, but you mess up 20 times and you never get punished for it, so there's no negative deterrent. And so what people were doing was just basically revoking as long as there was space in the jail or the prison or whatever the case may be. So looking at that, what they did is they basically earmarked something on the order of $256 million over the biennium to build up the facility, to build up local probation, to build up our CSCDs, our community supervision and corrections department, really build those things out, and then go back and make procedural changes to the actual policies for probation and parole and revocations, sentencing to probation and parole, starting to use probation as opposed to jail or prison for the as far as a sentence adjudication. And what happened is that ship they tried to do that in 2005. Rick Perry actually vetoed it in 2005 over some prosecutorial concerns. But in 2007, it went through, and that ship started turning right away. It was projected in the 2007 analysis that we needed 17,000 beds by the end of 2012, and the cost for just those extra beds, not to run them, was an additional $2.1 billion. So rather than spending that $2.1 billion, we spent the $256 million. And then if you look at our population, it just topped off and started heading down almost right away. So much so, we've actually closed, as of today, we've closed 4 prisons in the state. And again, we have many, many more. But we closed 4 full facilities in the state. And now the budget's being debated currently. But the Senate budget, and the Senate's the more conservative body now, the Senate budget is closing 4 prisons, and the House budget is closing 2. So at the very least, 2 more prisons will be closing this year. So bringing the total up to 6 or 8, whatever the case may be. So you generally see a pivot away from the carceral sanction and into more of the, probation or parole. And, to be honest with you, there's a lot of things that people don't realize that drive these things that just happen naturally. One great example is where you set your felony threshold for any sort of pecuniary loss, be it theft, fraud, whatever the case may be. So most states, like we did when back in 94 when we wrote the penal code, most states say, okay, you commit above X, it's a felony, and then it'll be like a value ladder. Well, what happens over time? We set ours to $1,500 in 1994. Well, $1,500 in 1994 went a hell of a lot farther than it does today. So one of the things that we did last session is we value adjusted. We basically adjusted for inflation the value of $1,500 in 1994 to what is that like in 2015. And so we basically raised our felony theft threshold to $2,500. It's now, we're tied with Wisconsin. It's the highest in the country. And we have absolute, and like our property crime rate is no different. You know, we're just pretty much right there on the national average. And so things like that, just those little changes, just really, really affect your criminal justice, your penal population. But not a lot of people think to make those. So yeah, just, you know, that's the carceral angle. And we've done, you know, we do things in policing, procedure, you know, we've expanded to the point of we almost do everything in the criminal justice system now. So I'd be happy to talk about any specific part of it if you'd like.
Yeah, I would love to talk about, so coming to a big picture view, what do you think are three changes that could be made either at the state or the federal level realistically in the next 2 to 4 years that would feel like progress to you?
Well, to be honest, and again, this is going to be something that a lot of liberals probably won't want to hear. I think that Donald Trump should kind of keep going on criminal justice the way he has initially signaled. Now, you have to keep in mind there's not a lot of meat to that right now. You know, he's done very little in the realm of criminal justice outside of its intersection with immigration, which to be honest with you, really isn't criminal justice, because if we're talking about immigration issues in and of itself, that's a civil issue. So one thing he has done in the budget he proposed completely guts the COPS office, the Office of Community Oriented Policing Services. Now, a lot of people go, oh my, why would he be against community policing? Well, the problem is, and this is what we've seen in so many different places, the problem is if people are taking money with marching orders from Washington, they have no desire to be responsive to the local population, and even less so can the local, the local legislature, be it a city council or a county commissioner's court, whatever, they can hold the, hold the purse strings, tight, or, you know, basically try to starve out any sort of bad behavior thing. It basically usurps the democratic process at the state and local level because they're getting the money from the feds. And the COPS office was the biggest violator of that. Now, there's still the Byrne grants, the justice assistance grants, that are basically used more for equipment than for salaries, but they can be used for salaries. But the problem is, again, with that, is that these monies that are passed to the state are never really tied with any sort of effectiveness or any sort of measurables that we can say, okay, well, this dollar, you know, begat X, or we were able to, you know, cut murders at one murder per, you know, however many thousands of dollars we sent to the state. I honestly think that making criminal justice, and that's, you know, hard stop writ large, criminal justice in all its forms, from the police to the courts to corrections, making that more locally responsible would do absolute numbers. And I also think that one of the things that needs to be done in terms of policing is this, and this is, the conservatives need help on this. The conservatives and liberals equally need help on this, because liberals do it from a labor perspective and conservatives do it from a back the blue perspective. Police unions are out of control. They are absolutely out of control right now. I can just tell you a few examples here in Texas. We actually have a police officer that works for us. He was a 21 year veteran up in Illinois. He moved down here. He was the director of the Tarrant County Community College's Criminal Justice Academy, the third largest Criminal Justice Academy in the state. So this guy knows policing and knows policing policy. He has been on the opposite side of the union establishment every single time he's testified. He testified in support of having a general police fitness standard. Again, basically saying people need to at least be able to run a mile in whatever it is, 10, 11 minutes, because if you aren't able to pursue a suspect, or you aren't able to, to protect yourself if a suspect were to attack you, the only options you have left are lethal options. And so when it comes to these shootings, when it comes to all these other bad uses of force, or even good uses of force that didn't necessarily have to be triggered, it's these fringe elements, the things like whether or not the police officer's in shape, are they given on-the-job training to stressful situations, things like that. You know, most officers can go, you know, an entire career without drawing a weapon, but that doesn't mean that all get to. And so training all of them as if they will have to is something that's important. And, you know, everyone thinks community relations in terms of policing is, well, have them in a parade and have them, you know, do national night out. And it's so much more than that. I mean, when you and I were growing up, you know, the police-citizen dynamic, the police-citizen relationship was so different. And that wasn't because, you know, police unions didn't exist, but it was because they became less of such a hard and fast political entity that needed to be either placated or assuaged or that had any sort of force to it. And that's, you know, I think that's where the big issue is, because the Democrats, like I said, Democrats partner with them on labor, Republicans partner with them on legitimacy, and it just, they tend to be given a blank check. And, you know, I'm no friend of teachers' unions either. Well, teachers' unions aren't for students, they're for teachers. And just the same way police unions aren't for the citizenry, they're for police. And so that's what I think is one thing that we can address when it has to do with the perception. Let's see, you said three. Not sure how many I gave you.
I think that's two.
You're right. The less federalization, watch for union. Oh, and then just to put a pedal on top of the union thing, you can substitute out police union for corrections officers unions in California and New York, and the argument's exactly the same. Look for any form of reform in either of those states. You will see official opposition from the actual unions. You know, they'll key vote bills that'll be something that we've done here in Texas 10 years ago. And so it's a real bizarre situation. So anyway, the third major reform that I think people can do, and again, this is going to be the most abstract possible as far as something where the rubber hits the road, is the mentality needs to be reformed. Because crime writ large is a behavior that, you know, that is morally blameworthy. It commands moral opprobrium, you know, in polite society, and we have to punish it. You know, we punish it through prison, probation, parole. But why do we punish it? If you remember me saying, a lot of the rehabilitation, a lot of the therapy, a lot of the treatment, which again, not to impugn anybody that was making policy back then, we sucked at it. We were very bad at rehabilitation, whether it was drug rehabilitation. We were incredibly bad at criminogenic rehabilitation. We were like one step above, you know, bloodletting and drilling holes in heads. But one thing that we need to do is we need to orient, once we have somebody and we are going to punish them, what does that punishment look like? Is the purpose of that punishment simply to inflict pain? Does it need to be solely retributive? Does it need to be solely to incapacitate? And don't get me wrong, incapacitation is something we need to do, but we shouldn't incapacitate for any longer than is necessary, and then necessary has more of a subjective definition. But what we need to do is we need to look at why we are punishing. We need to punish, in my estimation, we need to punish to rehabilitate. If someone's going to be locked up, they need to be getting treatment, they need to be getting therapy, whether that's drug and alcohol therapy, whether that's CBT, you know, some sort of cognitive behavioral therapy to actually focus on these criminogenic risk factors that they have, or even if it's something as simple as, you know, learning a trade. Now, a lot of people say, oh, give somebody a job and they're not criminal. You teach a criminal to cut hair in prison, somebody that has these innate criminogenic traits, the innate criminogenic factors, you teach them to cut hair in prison, then you just have a criminal barber. That's the only difference with that. But being able to address the aforementioned traits and then have them go into a job, that actually does help. That actually does keep that keeps them from very insular on from them recidivating. And the other thing that is part of that of why we punish, and we've forgotten this we've gotten so far away from this too. One thing we need to do is we need to make sure that the victim is still always present in the administration of justice. You know, a long time ago, you know, we actually had a more restorative version of justice, but that, you know, that led to blood debts and vendettas and things like that. So that's what gave rise to the idea of, you know, the king's peace. And any crime is a violation of the king's peace. You know, here it's a crime against the state. You know, it's never, you know, if I were to rob you, it wouldn't be Silvers v. Cohen. It would be, Cohen v. Silvers, it would be, you know, Cohen v. State. So I think that focusing more on restoration, whether that means, you know, rote restitution or whether that means restoration of the victim in other ways, I think that's a way to go. I do have to put a caveat there, though. That doesn't mean because sometimes victims and their representatives are completely retributive. That can't be the sole purpose of the criminal justice system, is that it is a legitimate vector for the use of retributivism, because otherwise then it's just we're back to the blood debt phase. Mm-hmm. Otherwise we're just.
Well, thank you so much. This is great. I really appreciate it. Would love to see your dissertation if you're willing to share it.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just forward you the PDF.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Derek.
All right. Have Thanks. A good one.
Bye-bye.
So, Beth, what's been on your mind this week besides politics? It couldn't be the beautiful travels you're taking right now.
Yeah, it's been hard to stay in touch with politics, really, because we've had such an interesting time. One thing, so let me tell you about today, I guess. We've been in the cities. We woke up today and took a drive up into the Scottish Highlands. And so we went through Glencoe, and you see just all of this land that's been basically untouched. We saw where they filmed Skyfall.
Oh, cool.
And where part of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban was filmed. And the countryside is just, I can't do it justice with words or with photos on my phone. And then we went up into Loch Ness and we took a boat and sailed on Loch Ness for a little bit, which was fun. Neat. We looked for Nessie and heard all kinds of lore about her. And the water there is just black. It's the craziest thing you've ever seen. I didn't realize how deep and how cold it is. And so we just got to learn a lot. But our tour guide, who was a character for sure, on the way up, used this word that I feel we should all adopt. He talked about stompers. He was saying that you should look for Nessie, because if you don't look for her, you're definitely not going to see her. And then he talked about all of these people who've spent their lives trying to prove that she isn't there. And he said, they're just stompers. That's what I call negative people, because they stomp on everyone else's dreams.
I love it. I love it.
I do too. So stompers, I think, needs to go into the vocab.
Stompers. That's great. Well, I've been following along, obviously, with everybody else, and I'm super jealous. We've been kicking off summer big time here. We've had Amos's birthday, Amos and Griffin's birthday party. Nicholas's birthday is this week. So we've been enjoying the sun, went to Kentucky Lake, went to visit some friends in Lexington. We've just been having a blast, and summer camps kick off next week. So we'll be having, or this week, I guess, since it's coming out on Tuesday. So we've been having a lot of fun.
That is awesome. I've been following pictures. Happy birthday, Amos.
Yeah, I have a six-year-old. They're growing up so fast. I also watched Sarah Silverman's new stand-up comic special on Netflix, I think it's called Speck of Dust. Very good, very funny. She talks about her brush with death. She had an abscess on her throat that she had to have emergency surgery for. That part is really good. I love her. So if you like stand-up comedy, highly suggest it.
Awesome.
So what's up next on your trip?
So tomorrow we're going to take a train back to London, and we think that we're going to rent a car and drive around the south of England from there. So we want to go down to like Brighton and East Hampton, I think. I'm getting confused on my cities because it's pretty late here when we're talking, but we're going to see Stonehenge. We're going to go to the track where they film Top Gear. That's important to Chad, and see the beaches and the White Cliffs. And then we'll head back toward the, we'll just kind of make our way back toward the airport. We fly back to Orlando on Thursday and back home to Cincinnati on Friday.
Oh, I can't wait for you to get it back. I know you're having a good time, but I'm ready for you to be back stateside.
Yeah, I am getting close to that. I miss my girls a lot. I'm having a really good time, but I do miss my children.
All right. Well, everybody, until Friday, when we will be sharing my interview with Jason Silverstein, we'd like to thank our executive producers, my husband, Nicholas Holland, Leslie, and Tracy, our new executive producers. We're so excited to have. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And please leave us reviews and ratings on iTunes. It helps more people find Pantsuit Politics. So we'll be there on Friday. Until then, keep it nuanced, y'all.